Well, as a part of our series that we've been looking at on a Monday morning, or on a Sunday morning, Monday morning's a different series, I'm ahead of myself. As a part of the series we've been looking at on Sunday mornings, we have been considering the character of God. We've been trying, in a sense, to do the impossible, which is to get a fresh look and an understanding of the God whom we worship. Now, we set out to do that, knowing that we can never completely do it, because he is an infinite God and we are finite people. But we have been setting about that task, and today we come to one of these absolutely marvellous passages of Scripture from the Old Testament, which uses language to the full to direct us towards God. So we're going to read that together. It would be good if you could have a Bible open. If you are using one of the church Bibles, it's on page 724. And we're going to read from verses 12 through to the end of the chapter, verse 31. Who has measured the waters in the hollow of his hand? Or with the breadth of his hand marked off the heavens? Who has held the dust of the earth in a basket, or weighed the mountains on the scales and the hills in the balance? Who has understood the mind of the Lord, or instructed him as his counselor? Whom did the Lord consult to enlighten him, and who taught him the right way? Who was it that taught him knowledge or showed him the path of understanding? Surely the nations are like a drop in a bucket. They are regarded as dust on the scales. He weighs the islands as though they were fine dust. Lebanon is not sufficient for altar fires, nor its animals enough for burnt offerings. Before him all the nations are as nothing. They are regarded by him as worthless and less than nothing. To whom then will you compare God? What image will you compare him to? As for an idol, the craftsman casts it, and a goldsmith overlays it with gold and fashions silver chains for it. A man too poor to present such an offering selects wood that will not rot. He looks for a skilled craftsman to set up an idol that will not topple. Do you not know? Have you not heard? Has it not been told you from the beginning? Have you not understood since the earth was founded? He sits enthroned above the circle of the earth, and its people are like grasshoppers. He stretches out the heavens like a canopy and spreads them out like a tent to live in. He brings princes to naught and reduces the rulers of this world to nothing. No sooner are they planted, no sooner are they sown, no sooner do they take root in the ground than he blows on them and they wither. And a whirlwind sweeps them away like chaff. To whom will you compare me? Or who is my equal, says the Holy One? Lift your eyes and look to the heavens. Who created all these? He who brings out the starry host one by one and calls them each by name. Because of his great power and mighty strength, not one of them is missing. Why do you say, O Jacob, and complain, O Israel, my way is hidden from the Lord, my cause is disregarded by my God? Have you not known? Do you not know? Have you not heard? The Lord is the everlasting God, the creator of the ends of the earth. He will not grow tired or weary, and his understanding no one can fathom. He gives strength to the weary and increases the power of the weak. Even youths grow weary and tired, and young men stumble and fall. But those who hope in the Lord will renew their strength. They will soar on wings like eagles. They will run and not grow weary. They will walk and not faint. but absolutely spectacular words. And we know that God will bless them to us. Our topic is, our subject is God beyond compare. And you can see where that comes from in the reading that we have. It occurred to me when trying to think about that there are some things that are relatively easy to compare. It's relatively easy to compare a Porsche and an Aston Martin. Not many have cause to do that, but if we did have cause to do it, it would be relatively easy to do. They are comparable cars. It might be a bit more difficult to compare a smart car with an Aston Martin. But again, we could probably make some sort of a stab at it. They have both four wheels and two seats and some headlights and an engine. But they're not really comparable. But then we could make it really difficult on the ultimate exam question. Please compare a banana and an Aston Martin. And you say, well, where do I start? These two things have nothing in common. And there is a sense where we are almost in that territory this morning. Whenever we start to answer the question, who do we compare God to? And that's what we want to turn our minds to. Now, we might think that God is beyond comparisons, yet if you live in the real world out there, you'll know that every single day we face such comparisons, often presented in a fairly cynical and insulting manner. Because those who do not know God, who have not taken the time to think about this, who have not taken the time to examine the God that the Bible speaks of, see him as just another idea. An old-fashioned piece of superstition. They have no problem making comparisons. And normally in their eyes, to the detriment of the Almighty. It's useful as we come to look at this particular passage, just to recognize that three little bits of context which I think help us maybe get a grasp on the passage and perhaps show us just how up to date this passage is in the world of 2007. First is that Isaiah lived in a society that was to some extent disintegrating. Although in the course of his prophecy he had experience of good kings during his time, and they were rare enough in the history of Judea, but Hezekiah was one that Isaiah would have had experience of. Yet Judea was to all intents and purposes, as we look at it from an historical perspective, getting beyond the point of no return. Its rejection of God, its superficiality, even when it seemed to be doing the right things, would soon lead to the successive generations experiencing the humiliation of defeat and deportation. The society was crumbling to some extent. The second piece of context was that everything Isaiah wrote was in the context of that wonderful vision he had, and which we have recorded for us near the beginning of the book. Isaiah was totally consumed by the memory of that day in which he saw the Lord high and lifted up. Nothing would ever be the same for him after that. And as he looks at his society, and as he looks at his world, and as he looks at his problems, as he looks at the sin, everything is put in Isaiah's mind in the context of the Lord. And of course, Isaiah, like every other human being ever since, whenever he got a glimpse of the Lord, he at the same time got a glimpse of himself and saw his sin and his wretchedness and his inadequacies for what they are. And that is a common experience. We cannot see God in all his glory without recognizing what we ourselves are. The third little bit of context is that had we read the earlier part of the chapter, the verses that lead into the verses that we're reading this morning, they deal with they foreshadow the good news of the gospel and the promises of God as a good shepherd. So quite a diverse context. A disintegrating society, a prophet absolutely overwhelmed by a vision of God, and a prophecy that presses us forward to the good news of the gospel. But this morning the task that we've been given is to deal with the question. The question which is first posed in the passage by Isaiah. In verse 18, to whom then will you compare God? What image will you compare him to? That's a question for you and I this morning. To whom then will you compare God? And in case we think this is just a human question that Isaiah has thought up for himself, a little later on in the question, God himself puts exactly the same question. To whom will you compare me? We find that in verse 25. So that's a question. To whom will you compare God? To whom will I compare God? I want to suggest to you that there are three comparisons here that are explicit or implicit in the passage. I would have to say I find this passage, despite being a passage that I have read many, many times and have enjoyed many, many times, I find the passage overwhelming. When I tried to prepare it, I said, there's just so much in this, I can't sort this out. It is just so immense. And so really, I'm only taking very little bits of it, and I hope you'll pardon that. The first comparison that Isaiah makes is a comparison with an idol. He says, to whom then will you compare God? What image will you compare him to? As for the idol. You can see Isaiah's point. He has already, in the verses leading up to verse 18 and 19, he has described God as having created the universe as effortlessly as a skilled craftsman constructing a model on his workbench. That's verse 12. He has presented him as infinitely wise. That's verses 13 and 14. He has presented him as totally sovereign in verse 15. And so holy as to be beyond the influence of sacrifices. That's verse 16. And completely unimpressed by the might of nations. That's verse 17. So he's built God up. I mean, he has allowed these thoughts to concentrate in his mind. He brings them all together and he said, now, you want to compare this God with an idol? Come on. And then he gives us some of the characteristics of the idol. We might be better, of course, to just define the word. We're not just talking about the physical idol that Isaiah was talking about. An idol is anything that takes the place of God in our lives, in our worship, in our beings. But in Isaiah's context, as he wrote it down here, it was a physical thing. And there's a degree of satire in his description. The idol, as Isaiah described it here, is cast in a base metal, in a cheap metal, in an easily workable metal. And then whenever it's cast, then they bring along the goldsmith to decorate it. Cover it up and make it look absolutely splendid, but the core of the thing is just a base metal. Oh, some decorative silver chains and some beaten out gold, as we find in chapter 41. But essentially, superficial. Then, of course, there are the people like most of us here who couldn't afford the gold and the silver chains. So what do we do? Well, we went and got a piece of hard wood, wood that wouldn't rot, and we hired a craftsman, and he carved us one. And then we said to him, now look, would you please nail that down? Or chapter 41 again. Would you please nail it down so that it won't topple over? You see how ridiculous this comparison is. This totally sovereign, powerful creator God that Isaiah has spoken about, and now a piece of bronze with gold on it, or a hunk of wood carved by a craftsman. And of course, both the craftsman and the purchaser know that the idol will eventually topple and fall down, because that's the way of idols. They're not permanent. Now, I think for each of us here this morning, starting with me, there is a very real challenge. And one that we really shouldn't ignore if we are serious about this God described in this chapter. Because our world is consumed with idol worship. And however much we wish it wasn't true, each one of us is in danger of being caught up in it. Let me just give you, and these are in no particular order, so I'm not getting at myself or anybody else, just some of the things that you can immediately see as idols if you pick up your Saturday papers and just read through them. Here are some of them. Clothes. Yep. There are people who worship clothes. Status. Lots of people who worship status. Homes. Great thing to have been given a home. Millions in the world haven't got them. Some of us have raised them to the status of idols in our lives. Recreations. Nothing wrong with recreation. Shopping. I can honestly say that that is one that is not a temptation for me. But maybe it's the only one. Cars. You almost see some of the lascivious looks whenever the picture of the Aston Martin went up. But yeah, we do that, don't we? Holidays. Money. Career. And you know, sometimes in our sinful state, it's even possible to put church into that category. Where we lose sight of the God we worship and we idolize the institution or the denomination or the building or the facilities or whatever. Now, it's very easy to test yourself here. Look down that list. And this is a hard question, I'm sorry, but it's the only one I can think of. Which one of those would cause you to miss the midweek meeting or the Sunday evening service? We know they're transient. We know they're superficial. We know they're inherently worthless in the great scheme of God's eternity. But there's a challenge. The second word that I think is implicit in the passage is, how does God compare with power blocks? Whenever I was a small child, my first atlas had a slightly outdated map, a little bit about this, where the countries of the British Empire were coloured pink. It was the greatest formal empire in the history of the world. At its peak, it covered a quarter of the world's landmass and just over a quarter of the world's population. My parents' generation saw it crumble and all but disappear. My generation saw the almighty Soviet bloc that we lived in fear of whenever we were growing up as children crumble and disappear. Your generation will see the same thing happen again to some great nation, perhaps America, I don't know. Why? Because God is in control. They have vast armies, immense weapons, incredible power, but to the Almighty, they're as powerful as grasshoppers. Their reigns are of minimal duration, and in the very roots of their success lie the seeds of their destruction. They are transient. Which is not to underestimate the pain and distress and fear, and even occasionally the good they cause. Isaiah looked round his crumbling society and knew that hard and painful times lay ahead. The Assyrians were mopping up the countries all around Judea, and yet he could see that God is in control. Can you compare God to an empire? Don't be ridiculous. One is eternal, one, the other, is a blink in history. They are unimportant in the eternal scheme of things. He rolls out the heavens like a canopy or a tent. Here again is the challenge or the warning for us. What do we trust in? Governments, financial institutions, being a part of Britain, being a part of Ireland, having a nuclear deterrent, having a big army, having a police force that we like, having political armies, allies, having friends in America or investments in London or whatever it is. What do we trust in? When we get down to the honesty that God demands of us, what do we trust for our security? And the answer is not what you're saying to yourself now in church. The answer will be shown by how you live your life in the incoming week. Empire. The third word that I think is implicit in this passage is intellect. I've used the word intellect as a piece of shorthand for verses 25 and 26 and for verses 13 and 14, which are on the same theme. In verse 25, it's God himself who speaks and directs our views upward. In our world, we are forever being confronted by a question which is put in terms of, given how much we now know, do we need God as an explanation any longer? The comparison here is between man's most profound thoughts and God's infinite wisdom. I heard two very interesting clips on the radio on the way to work this week. One was that biologists are much more likely to be atheists than physicists or astronomers. The speaker speculated that looking through a microscope gave a sense of perspective that encouraged man to think of himself as important, while looking through a telescope put man in a perspective where he is tiny. The other article on the radio was about a debate among physicists that the theories they have been following for a generation are incapable of producing a unified theory of everything. One leading professor said that no one had come up with a theory which had the clarity, beauty, and coherence to be convincing on its own. Now, those of you who know me know that this is not a rant against science. This is not me trying to put to one side many of the amazing and wonderful discoveries and insights that scientists have made and do make. After all, science is at its heart but a pursuit or an investigation into the creation all around us. But what I am saying is, whenever it comes to a comparison, where do you stand? The thoughts of the brightest men in the world or God's infinite wisdom? I also had sent to me this week by email a series of pictures which I would like to show you because they make the point, it seems to me. Here's a little picture of the Earth compared with some of the other planets in our solar system. As you can see, the Earth is a respectable looking planet, much bigger than some. If, however, we move on and compare the Earth with the other planets in the solar system, and these are our nearest neighbours in space, you can see that the Earth really is quite diminutive. All of these planets, of course, go around the Sun, the nearest star to us. And so if we just see what they look like compared with the Sun, we start to look rather small indeed. But then the Sun is only one of billions of stars, even in our own galaxy. So let's just have a little look and see what the Sun looks like when you compare it with some of its neighbours. By this stage, Jupiter is represented by one pixel in the picture. But those aren't really the big boys. Those are just the sort of medium-sized guys. So let's look at it compared with one of the bigger ones. Now, I show you those pictures to make the point that we have no need to be embarrassed not to accept what some of the most brilliant minds in our tiny little world come up with in the context of a universe like this. Nor must we dismiss them. They have God-given brains and God-given intellects. But just remember what the passage said. He who brings out the starry host one by one, calls them by name, and because of his great power and mighty strength, not one. Not one is missing. To whom would you compare God? An idol? An empire? An intellect? If the chapter concluded at this point, you might be convinced and even inspired by the magnificence of God. But you might perhaps be left wondering, in light of these pictures, if the God of such an infinite universe could have any interest in me. If my little earth doesn't even generate a pixel on the computer screen, and I am one of, I don't know how many billion people on that earth, is this great big God we were singing about really interested in me? I think Isaiah probably got there before us. You see, the glory of God but is not just in his power, but also in his love. God is involved. There's no detail too small for his attention. Just look at the promise at the end of this chapter. There are folks in church this morning who are weary. Weary because of the stresses of life, exhausted by the events that have overwhelmed them. There are folks in church this morning stumbling because the demands are too great. Some of us are falling because we're not up to the challenge. The old, the young, the in-between, we all share the experience. And to each of us, this great God says, not only do I not grow tired or weary, or disinterested myself, but I give you my strength, I share my power, I renew your strength. Come, soar with me. Run without weariness. Walk without fainting. Just as we conclude, look at the words. Down the one side, the words that at some point or another in our lives, and maybe more frequently than we would be happy to admit, mark us weary, weak, tired, stumbling, falling. And then look down at the words on the other side that come to us from this great and mighty and holy God: strength, power, running, walking, soaring. I was looking at a commentary, obviously, as I tried to prepare this, and I came across a little bit in the preface of Barry Webb's commentary, which he had subtitled "Soar Like Eagles." The commentary is subtitled that, and this is what he wrote in his preface, and with this I'd like to conclude. Writing this book has been a flight that I will never forget. I have soared into the heavens and seen the glory of God, and with new eyes I have seen this world and my own place in it. The view has been breathtaking. I am not less mortal or sinful than I was before. My awareness of these things has been sharpened, not diminished, but I am surer now than ever before that there are no obstacles to my communion with God, or to the full realization of what he has purposed for me. I have heard the seraphim cry, "The whole earth is full of the glory of his glory," and so it is. I live in expectation of the day when he will take his power and reign and know with absolute certainty that because of the one who was pierced for my transgressions, the new heavens and the new earth will be my home forever. Such flights are not for the privileged few. It is the birthright of all God's people. I invite you to fly with me. He gives strength to the weary and increases the power of the weak. Even youths grow tired and weary, and young men stumble and fall. But those who hope in the Lord will renew their strength. They will soar on wings like eagles. They will run and not grow weary. They will walk and not be faint. And may that be each of our experiences this week. Let's pray.